I'd like to introduce this session, and before I do, I was asked to tell everyone that the books are going to be put in boxes after this session, so if you want to buy books, that you need to go down and take a look. My name is Jan Eyring, professor at Cal State Fullerton, and I was asked to be the chair of this session, and at first I thought I was going to be the respondent, and Armin Ma said, oh no, you know, there's going to be enough discussion engendered that we want plenty of time for people to ask questions and answers and that kind of thing. So I'm going to kind of be the, I'll say something at the end, but pretty much it's going to be the audience talking to the speakers. Our first speaker is Jared Christensen, and he is a returned missionary from Columbus, Ohio. He's 22 years old, currently living in Farmington, Utah, and studying business at Weber State College. And some of you may know this, but he is the son of Steve Christensen, who was one of the Mark Hoffman bomb victims back in the 80s. He's going to be speaking on the price of openness. And then we're going to hear from Jeff Burton, who is a member of the Sunstone Board of Trustees, and he lives in Bountiful, Utah, and he especially wanted me to mention that he's an author of a book that relates directly to the topic he's going to be talking on today, and that is For Those Who Wonder. And that this is available down at the book table. So with that introduction, Jared, I guess we'll have you start. And the title of this session is great, I think, Coping in the Mormon Borderlands. Oh, do you want to go over here? Okay.
Well, I really like the title of this discussion because I think it's kind of the theme of what I think of when I think of Sunstone. I think most of us have probably had to cope in Mormon borderlands at some point in our lives. I'd like to start out with one of my favorite quotes. It's by Heber C. Snell, and he talks about history and scholarship, and this is what he says. He says, "One does not write history if he allows his own theological views to change the facts and obscure their true meaning. But while the historian must not be biased by his own ideas, he must be fully sympathetic with those of the people whose story he is telling. He must be sympathetic with and at the same time critical of them. In this way, only can he hope to deal with his materials honestly. Histories of religious movements have often been written with a strong bias for presenting only the favorable side of the picture. Such works are not history at all, much as they may claim to be." As Jan said, the title of my Price of Openness, and I don't want price to strike a negative chord within you guys. I looked up the definitions of price. Another definition of price that maybe we don't think of is value or worth, and so maybe that would be a better title, the value or worth of openness. And the reason I mention this is because I feel that the rewards are far greater in being open to those around us about our views than being more closed off and afraid to share our feelings. I guess kind of this talk kind of stems from a talk or a paper that I wrote for Sunstone and came out in the December issue, and so I wrote it in October, so that was quite some time ago. So I'd like to take a few minutes and maybe just give some background about what that article was about to kind of give some background for what I'm going to talk about today. The title of the paper that I wrote was called My Great Dilemma, and so maybe I'll just read a little bit from that, if I may. First paragraph starts out, "Church-wise, things are pretty blurry for me right now. I'm angry, frustrated, and bewildered. Yet paradoxically, I also feel like my need for spirituality and my commitment to finding truth have never been stronger. I grew up in an environment where Mormonism was synonymous with perfection, swimming in a pool of, the church has to be true. It makes so much sense, and I know beyond a shadow of a doubt." And so during my teenage years, this is kind of how I grew up, and I always had a desire to serve a mission, although I really didn't have that testimony at that point. And so I decided to go on my mission, and the day I went into the MTC, I felt like I was given a gift to be able to search out and find truth. And I remember finding a quote from Brigham Young, and it's still one of my favorites today, and this is the attitude I had as I was on my mission for 2 years. And Brigham said, "It is our duty and calling as ministers of the same salvation and gospel to gather every item of truth and reject every error. Whether a truth be found with professed infidels or with any of the various and numerous different sects and parties, all of whom have more or less truth, it is the business of the elders of this church to gather up all the truths in the world pertaining to life and salvation, to the gospel we preach, to mechanism of every kind, to the sciences, and to philosophy, wherever it may be found in every nation, kindred, tongue, and people, and bring it to Zion. And so this was my attitude, was to find every truth I could. In my first area on my mission, there was a lot of people who were, you know, quote, anti-Mormon, and who were out to try to prove us wrong. And most missionaries would pass off what they said as lies, because we grew up learning that anti-Mormonism, it's lies, and it'll make us question our faith. And so most missionaries didn't want to delve into it. But I, first and foremost, wanted to work out these concerns with the people who I was supposed to be teaching. And so that led me to read materials to find out what the claims they were, what they were making, to find out if they were true or not. And some of them had to do with my father, reading the books about the events that happened with his death. And those books led me to other books, as they would talk about certain things like Fawn Brody and Joseph Smith and polygamy, and these were things that I didn't really know. I didn't know they existed within Mormondom, and so these were things that I studied and really opened my eyes to what I like to call the dark side of church history. And so I felt myself change on my mission as I started to feel myself drift away from maybe what the normal missionary was. I had a desire to serve people, but I still had a lot of questions within the Mormon faith and maybe what my own testimony was. Some of my concerns, I mentioned some of those. They're probably some of the same concerns that all of us have. And I listed those. And in regards to my father, I'll just read a paragraph about some of my concerns of the events that occurred when he was killed, with the things that went on there. I said, "But my heartache goes even deeper, for it's been almost unbearable to look at the way church officials handled the murder investigations of my father. While investigators were trying to find the killer, church leaders were unwilling to give information that only they knew. It was more than a lack of cooperation. In some cases, their evasiveness bordered on outright lying. My father had dedicated his time, talent, money, and energy to the church, yet in return he didn't receive supporting testimony from church officials during the trial of his killer. All of the issues above have created for me what I call my great dilemma. I find it nearly impossible to give a sustaining vote to men who I feel abandoned my family in a most critical time." And so that's kind of where I'm still at today. And so from that point, I'll go on to what I prepared today. There was, I guess, a lot of aftermath after I wrote that article from friends and family and different people who, you know, I just returned home from a mission not too long after I wrote that paper, so I think it was a shock to a lot of people that this is where I was at. I guess I'll first just briefly mention how it's affected the relationships with the people in my immediate family. I think that it's actually brought me closer to each person in my family. I found out through talking to my older brother, I never talked to him about issues, but found out that he also went through the same experience as I did on his mission. And it was kind of interesting how that happened. He was teaching a couple. He served in Florida, and they didn't have a lot of baptisms there, and they had a couple who was ready for baptism. And then they called him and said, we don't want anything to do with the church anymore. And he asked them, well, why not? And they said, well, we heard about those bombings that happened in Salt Lake and saw what the church leaders had done, and we can't join the church if we're going to be supposed to be sustaining these men who were being dishonest. And so my brother was like, well, I didn't know that church leaders were dishonest. He didn't really know any details about it. And so he kind of went through the same process as I did to find out the facts and exactly what did happen. And so me and him were able to relate on a new level that I didn't know that we had those same things in common. And of course, he's chose now to stay active in the church as he's been able to work through his issues. And that's my brother right there. My other brother that's just older than me has been inactive since he was 14 or 15 because of some of the things I've been talking about. And so I was able to relate to him too, as he was able now to see someone else in his family who understood his concerns and wouldn't judge him for the views that he had. And then also now my little brother, who's he's not preparing to go on a mission, he's trying to decide if he wants to go on one. And so I'm thankful that I'm able to give him a kind of both sides of the spectrum. I went on a mission. I actually loved my mission. I don't regret ever going. I'm glad that I went. And so I'm thankful that I'm able to give him both sides of the story and to give him an honest view of how a mission would be, and I guess what it takes to be a missionary. Now, of course, there are some negative things that came along with being open. I my grandparents were asking my mom how I was doing, you know, with church activity and this and that. And so she's like, well, maybe I'll just let him read your article because that kind of explains where you're at. And my grandparents are pretty staunch Mormons. My grandpa's been a bishop and in the state presidency, and they just left for their fourth mission for the church, and so they're pretty staunch Mormons. And pretty soon after they read my article, I got an email from them, and that's what was puzzling to me. Is I'm close with my grandparents. I talk to them a lot. I see them all the time, but I got an email, which I'd never received an email from them before. So I'd like to just read some of the things that they said in their email. Dear Jared, your grandmother and I were saddened and disappointed after reading your article in Sunstone. We love and respect your right to use free agency, although we may not agree with how you are using it at this time. In 1 Nephi 14:10 it states, "Behold, there are save two churches only. The one is the church of the Lamb of God, and the other is the church of the devil. When it looks at the good the church has done in the past, is doing now, and will do in the future, it would be hard to make a good argument that it is not the church of the Lamb." Then they said, "Wherefore, by their fruits ye shall know them." 3 Nephi 14:20. I think that's kind of a double-edged sword statement there. "It must therefore be the church of the Lamb of God and must be true. It follows then that any group or organization that is fighting against the churches are the church of the devil." Jared, this anti-Mormon literature has been around for ages. We have never bothered to read it, any of it in detail. People waste their lives and often the lives and happiness of their family searching for dirt under the pretense of being more informed and intellectual than the common membership of the church. If some of these negative things you have read are true, and we doubt that many of them are, that is between them and the Lord. He will deal with them in his own way, and we should have faith that he will do it justly. It should not be the concern of petty people who want to waste their time in the name of, quote, seeking for the truth, to be making judgments on people that the Lord is responsible for. If the prophets have made serious mistakes in their lives in the past, and we have no reason to believe that they ever have, I say, in capital letters, so what? The fact that the church has continued to spread throughout the earth, doing good, despite the death of Joseph Smith, proves that it is the Church of Jesus Christ. Please don't be one of the very elect that will be defeated in the last days. And so that's to me, one of the negative responses that I got, that I felt like my grandparents hadn't even read the article. I thought I was pretty... I tried not to be too harsh about the... I didn't even go into details about my concerns. I just listed a few of them, and I felt that... I guess that was kind of hard for them to tell someone who's just trying to figure out what they believe and what's true, that they're disappointed and saddened that you're on that path. And so this is kind of the... I read some of these quotes earlier, but I think they're important, so I'll read them again. But this is some of the... My friend over here, he coined a phrase that I like to say all the time. It's fear in a faith-promoting church. And that's what I see sometimes a lot in the church, is they use fear to try to motivate people, and I can't stand that. And so I want to read a couple quotes that I think show that. This first one is from Elder Holland that he gave recently in General Conference. He says, "I speak carefully and lovingly to any of the adults of the church, parents or otherwise, who may be given to cynicism or skepticism, who in matters of whole-souled devotion always seem to hang back a little, who at the church's doctrinal campsite always like to pitch their tents out on the periphery of religious faith. To all of whom we do love and wish were more comfortable camping nearer to us, I say, please be aware that the full price to be paid for such a stance does not always come due in your lifetime, with payments coming out of your children's and grandchildren's pockets in far more expensive ways than you ever intended to be. In such basic matters of faith, prophets do not apologize for requesting unity, indeed conformity." And so, as I've pondered those words, it kind of makes me sad, as it makes me feel like I don't have a place if this is going to be the theme that the church is putting across to people who want to seek out truth and try to find out what's true for them. And so, one of the great, I think, paradoxes in the church is how there can be so many statements like that, but yet so many other wonderful statements from past prophets and general authorities. So I like to kind of focus on the ones that, I guess, more affirm where I'm at. I'll read this quote from Joseph Smith, and then maybe just one more. Joseph said, "I will not seek to compel any man to believe as I do, only by the force of reasoning, for truth will cut its own way. I ask, did I ever exercise any compulsion over any man? Did I not give him the liberty of disbelieving any doctrine I've preached if he saw fit? It looks too much like the Methodists, not like the Latter-day Saints. Methodists have a creed which a man must believe or be asked out of their church. I want the liberty of thinking and believing as I please. It feels so good not to be trammeled. It does not prove the man is not a good man because he errs in doctrine. And so to me, that's a total contradiction of Elder Holland's statement that the church is going to demand conformity on matters of doctrine. Probably my favorite quote, I only heard it maybe a couple months ago, and it's became my favorite, is by Hugh B. Brown. And interestingly enough, he gave this to students who were at BYU. This is at a devotional given in 1958. He says, I hope that you will develop the questioning spirit. Be unafraid of new ideas, for they are the stepping stones of progress. You will, of course, respect the opinions of others, but be unafraid to dissent if you are informed. Now, I have mentioned freedom to express your thoughts, but I caution you that your thoughts and expressions must meet competition in the marketplace of thought. And in that competition, truth will emerge triumphant. Only error needs to fear freedom of expression. Seek the truth in all fields. And in that search, you will need at least three virtues: courage, zest, and modesty. The ancients put that thought in the form of a prayer. They said, from the cowardice that shrinks from new truth, from the laziness that is content with half-truth, from the arrogance that thinks it has all truth, O God of truth, deliver us. And so for me, I think I'm going to choose to follow those words as opposed to the ones that I previously stated. Brigham Young, interestingly enough, he has a lot of contradictory statements. He talks a lot about obeying the brethren and what I would see as maybe blind faith. But he actually has a pretty great quote that I like to use when I think about general authorities. He said, I'm more afraid that this people have so much confidence in their leaders that they will not inquire for themselves of God whether they are led by him. I am fearful that they're down in a state of blind self-security. Let every man and woman know by the whispering of the Spirit of God to themselves whether their leaders are walking in the path that the Lord dictates or not. So I guess I'll just share maybe one more negative experience from being open to the people around me. I received a call. Well, I got a call from one of my missionary companions who was home with me, and he said that he had heard about something that was going on in the mission that we came from. And what was happening was that there was, and this is right when I'd returned home from my mission, there was a rumor in the mission that I had become inactive from the church, had anti-Mormon material, and I had gone off the deep end, and now I wasn't going to church anymore. This was actually at a time where I was attending church, and so that's what was really strange. But according to the missionary, this is what they were saying in the different zone meetings as they would go around the mission. And this is, I'm quoting what he said to me. He says, Elder Christensen was a great missionary, a zone leader, one who was looked up to in the mission. However, he read anti-Mormon material on his mission, and now it has ruined his testimony. And subsequently, he has left the church and gone off the deep end. This was given by one of the assistants who were putting on the meeting. And so that was really hurtful for me at a time where, you know, I was still searching out, but I was still attending church, but this was something that was being promoted to the missionaries across the mission, and they were using this to try to suppress missionaries from reading material other than the missionary library or the books that they wanted them to read, saying, you know, you can be a great missionary, but if you read things other than these books, then this is where you could end up. And so I called the assistants to the president to talk to him about the situation, and also wrote my mission president a letter, and he actually sent me a nice letter back, but I was puzzled in the sense that he didn't apologize for what happened, and he also just told me that he had heard from other sources that I was inactive, but yet him and the assistants didn't come to me. I mean, if I was inactive and they wanted to come to me and say, this is what we're going to talk about, that was one thing, but I guess I kind of felt betrayal from someone who I was close to, my mission president and the assistants, in that sense. So these were some of the disappointing things in being open and still around me, but I think that it bringing me closer to my family and making, I kind of feeling like I'm getting a monkey off my back and just letting everyone know where I'm at. It's been definitely worth it for me. And I don't share those negative experiences to try to get pity from anyone, but just to show that in being open there will be things like that will occur. So I'll just close with two more thoughts. The first one comes from Sterling McMurrin. He says, unlike men in bondage or the less popular forms of slavery, those enslaved by religion do not know that they are not free. This can be religion's most subtle evil, for because of it, men are often robbed of their dignity without knowing what they have lost. And then the second is John chapter 8, verse 32. And you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Jeff Burton. We all have had kind of experiences like we've heard from today from Jared, and you're starting on a journey that most of us have been through at one time or another, and we hope it'll turn out well for you. But when I was talking to Dan Witherspoon about what to talk about, he said, well, there's a good likelihood that we'll have a number of people from the Claremont Theological School here. And so I've kind of tailored my remark to the idea that we might have some from that school here. But let me just ask this. Do we have any students from the school here? Do we have any non-LDS people here? Okay. Well, keep in mind then as we go through this talk that was kind of the way it was set up. I found over the years that there's two ways to do these kind of talks. One is to, you know, just try to ad lib and go and keep my notes and so forth. It kind of goes slow that way. The other way is to read it, and then it's kind of you kind of lose people. But the way I found the best way to do it is to kind of read it, but give you a copy. So I'm going to ask, would you guys pass those out, or maybe Jan will help me in that. What I like to do, these paragraphs are numbered. It's not supposed to look at scripture or anything, but this is so that I can stop and say, you know, I want to make comments as we go through. And I'm not quite ready to start yet, but I'll tell you when I'm ready. And when I stop, I'll say stop, and then I'll make a few comments. But I could read the whole thing in probably 10 minutes, so I'll make comments as we go. Then you'll have something to carry away with you. For years, I have been interested. For some reason, I fell into this situation where I've been helping people who, you know, find themselves somehow out of the main group of LDS Center, Group 1, what I call. And over the years, you know, I've presented papers at Sunstone. The first one was on the closet doubter back in 1982. And I didn't know it at the time, but J.D. Williams, do you know him? He was a famous, well-known political science professor at the University of Utah, and I think he's an emeritus professor now. He's been about 20 years. So. But, I mean, he came to follow me to respond to my paper, and he came out of the closet. And it was kind of a shock to me because I didn't know he was going to do that. And I don't think anybody, but maybe Peggy knew that. And if I thought to myself, if I'd known this was going to happen, you know, I'm not sure I would have been willing to do this paper, because I'm not encouraging people to come out of the closet. I'm encouraging them to be thoughtful about it and not make a big splash, to do it at the right time and so forth. But anyway, this paper is called Revisiting the Phenomenon of the Closet Doubter, and we were hoping that if we had any students here, we might see whether or not we see this problem in other faiths as well. So let me start by reading. Let me ask one other question. How many here? Well, let's do the negative thing. How many here do not subscribe to Sunstone? Well, you guys have got to get on it. Okay, those of you who have who do take Sunstone, which of you have never heard of my column, The Borderlanders? Okay, so you're reading it. I get very little feedback, and I wonder, you know, is anybody reading this thing? I get some of the more dramatic things, of course, but anyway. Let me restart this. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, LDS or Mormon, is unique in many ways. I will describe one of the peculiar features, testimony, and its consequences for a group of Mormons I call closet doubters. Since at least as early as 1835, members have been admonished and expected to get a testimony of the unique restoration claims of the Church. To know that Joseph Smith was a prophet of God, the Book of Mormon was translated from angel-delivered ancient golden plates, and a church established by Christ during his earthly reign was restored by Joseph Smith, and so forth. These are the central restoration claims that are unique to our church. Today's church sees having a testimony as an important measure of a member's worth and standing. Such questions as, do you have a testimony of the restoration, are routine in temple recommended personal interviews. This expectation is so prevalent at all levels of the church that those not able to testify, having fundamental knowledge, often feel unworthy and suspect in the eyes of regular true believers. And in fact, many regular members of the church are suspicious of those not having a testimony. The peculiar response to this expectation has been the creation of closet doubters, active members of the church who either pretend to know or who remain silent about their questions about or lack of belief in these fundamental restoration claims. I first described the closet doubting phenomenon in 1982 at another Sunstone symposium. I hoped at the time we might see it disappear once we started to talk about it, but unfortunately this is not the case, and many Mormons here today, like me, relate to the ongoing phenomenon. I hope you will come away from our session with a few ideas of how to deal with the problem. Because our audience also includes many non-Mormons, I will explain a few fundamentals of Mormonism as we go along. I'll try to skip some of those. Just one thing on this part B here. I think it's really important for all of us to be really careful about how we use the words testimony, belief, faith, and doubt. And I want to read these real quick to you. The way I use them, and the way I think it'd be better if we all thought of it, at least during this session, we think about it this way. To believe or to have a belief, in its modern sense, to believe is to accept or conclude something from a base of reliable data. For example, if we flip a coin 50 times and tabulate the results, we are likely to believe or have a belief that each comes up about equal. Personal belief implies a conscious mental acceptance of something based on reason, experience, information, evidence, prejudice, or the authority of the source. Personal beliefs are modified and tested by the day-to-day experiences and information supplied to the mind. To know is to have a clear intellectual understanding as a result of study, experience, reasoning, evidence, or very strong authority. Knowing is a step above belief. At some point, belief becomes strong enough to be thought of as knowledge or to be expressed as a testimony in LDS parlance. Indeed, LDS testimonies usually contain statements of doing. I know Joseph Smith was a prophet. In this sense, knowing is closely related to having a testimony. Having faith is in something, for example, having faith in the Book of Mormon implies making a bridge between what we know or believe about the book and what the book claims to be. Faith implies a sin acceptance, a willingness to follow the book's teachings in spite of absence of convincing evidence or a sure knowledge. And finally, to doubt. Doubt in the modern sense, and the way I use it, it means to be unsettled in belief or opinion, to be uncertain or undecided. It means not having sufficient information to create a belief or knowledge or to have a testimony. So I use the term doubt here primarily as an absence of positive belief or knowledge. I'm not using the older negative religious meanings like distrust, nihilism, and reject. See, LDS testimony. When we attend almost any meeting of members of the LDS Church, we expect to hear something like, "In closing, I testify that I know the Book of Mormon is true. I know Joseph Smith was a prophet of God. I know the LDS Church is Christ's true church." Church leaders at all levels constantly express their fundamental testimonies and encourage members to do likewise. Jeffrey R. Holland, a member of the Church's Quorum of the 12 Apostles, recently warned members in a general church conference about the eternal negative consequences of not bearing testimony to their children on a regular basis. If we ask a testimony-bearing church member, "How do you know that Joseph Smith was a prophet?" The believer is likely to respond, "Because I prayed about it, and the Holy Ghost has manifested the truth of these things to me." The manifestation of the truth is sometimes described as a burning and a feeling that it is right, something suggested by LDS Scripture, Doctrine and Covenants, Section 9, Verse 8. Stop just for a second. This is the part that I was going to address to the non-LDS participants, but it wouldn't hurt to review it again. From D&C 9:8, "Behold, I say unto you, that you must see it out in your mind. Then you must ask me if it be right. And if it is right, I will cause that your bosom shall burn within you. Therefore you shall know that it is right." And I want to stop here just for one second. You know, this is an awful subjective kind of thing. You know, a lot of people get the same kind of burning in the bosom they get when they see the American flag and that kind of thing. And it leads to problems because, you know, if it's so easy to get a testimony, it's pretty easy to lose it. And so some people who have their testimony based on that burning in the bosom kind of thing, sometimes they'll read a book like Origins of Power, which is a perfectly good book, and it's not anti-Mormon in any way, and yet they'll read that and have their testimony shaken. So I just recently read that excellent book, one of the best books I've ever read. But anyway, I didn't lose my faith. So, according to the Book of Mormon, in Moroni, chapter 10, verse 4, a testimony of the faithfulness of the Book of Mormon can be obtained as follows. When you shall receive these things, I would exhort you that you would ask God, the Eternal Father, in the name of Christ, if these things are not true. I'm going to sit here just for a second. I've had people say to me, this is interesting wording, if these things are not true. I've had people say to me, yeah, I prayed about it, and I found, yeah, they're not true. So we have to be kind of careful here. And if you shall ask with a sincere heart, with real intent, having faith in Christ, he will manifest the truth of it unto you by the power of the Holy Ghost. LDS scriptures thus contain powerful but conditional and sometimes vague divine promises of a God-given knowledge or certainty that makes the LDS church unique among Christian churches. Most churches as Christians are content to live Christ's teachings and follow God's commandments on the basis of faith, not expecting everyone to receive a divine witness that they are true. And the caveats and the conditions, asking with a sincere heart, real intent, and having faith in Christ, can be a problem for some, in fact for many. For an unsuccessful seeker of testimony, it can result in the what's wrong with me syndrome. I don't know how many people I've talked to. I'm just talking for a second. I don't know how many people I've talked to over the years who have said, you know, I'm not getting it. You know, don't I have real intent? You know, does God hate me? I've got some sort of sin that I don't realize is happening to me? You know, don't I have enough faith? And so, of course, it's been a problem. And of course, for the true believer, I'm going back to my text, and for the true believer, it is what's wrong with him syndrome. And neither are helpful in our church. Section D, origins of the personal LDS testimony. During my lifetime, no one has told me that they have had a direct revelation from God. And I ask frequently, I ask everybody I meet, you know, if the opportunity comes up, well, you know, what's your situation? And some have had experiences that they interpret to have had divine origins. In an informal survey, for example, one of 20 or so members of an LDS branch in Japan had received a divine witness. And just a couple of weeks ago, I recently met a woman who had heard a voice in the temple that she took to be a divine confirmation and the source of her testimony. She didn't want to give me the details, and I didn't press her for the specifics, but it was kind of a non-specific voice. And you know, it's these kind of testimonies that are easily shaken, unfortunately. For many true believers, their testimonies have had origins in feelings and emotions, sources of evidence not generally acceptable in scientific inquiry. The scripture, your bosom shall burn within you, therefore you shall feel that it is right, is suggestive of this approach to knowledge. Another important source of LDS testimony is the voice of authority. When the missionaries, our leaders, or our parents declare that the church is the one and only true church, the authority of that source is strong enough for many to assume the truthfulness of the statement. Others may say, I just know, that's all, without having given their source of knowledge much thought. Stop right here. You know, a lot of people who are true believers and are active supporters of our religion and so forth, the active people, they don't really reason out their testimony. They don't really reason through their faith. And, of course, the problem with that is that when they don't, when something crops up that challenges that testimony, it's easy for them to lose it. And I'll talk more about that in a little bit. Another common source of testimony, of course, is personal experience. For example, it doesn't take much personal experience to come to know that honesty is the best policy or that sharing is right, and indeed obeying or testing any of the behavior-based commandments usually results in a personal knowledge or testimony of the correctness and worth of that commandment. On the other hand, as it pertains to a testimony of the restoration, it is impossible to live or test the existence of the golden plates, the reality of Joseph Smith's first visions, or whether or not Joseph Smith correctly identified the location of the Garden of Eden in Missouri, for example. Section E. As I mentioned earlier, not every baptized Mormon successfully receives a testimony of the fundamental origins of Mormonism as promised in LDS scripture and by church leaders. And many are not able to retain the testimony they thought they had. What happens to these folks? Statistics suggest that about 80% of those baptized worldwide, talking about Bountiful, Utah, but worldwide, leave the church or become non-participators during their lifetimes. Around Bountiful, it's about 50%. Some significant but unknown fraction of the departing 80% are those who find it difficult to obtain a testimony or lose their testimonies. They simply separate themselves from the church. Incidentally, losing your testimony is considered one of the worst things that can happen to a member, and if it happens to someone else, it is usually thought to have involved sin or other personal shortcomings. And I'll stop here just for a second. We hear all the time general authorities and other people saying, you know, I've never seen a situation yet where somebody lost their testimony or there wasn't sin involved someplace, sometime. Well, you know, that's the way it is for all of us. You know, even the people who have a testimony, if you pin them down, sure, there's been some sin in their life sometime. I mean, that's not really a good excuse for why people lose their testimony. Some stay active without the fundamental testimony. A very few may stay with complete openness, but I personally know of no one today who pursues the completely open course. The vast majority of the active without testimonies members become, to some degree, closet doubters, where doubt is mostly the positive definition, a lack of belief or testimony that I mentioned earlier. I'll relate my own experience in a few moments, but first let me answer a few questions related to closet doubters. What defines a closet doubter? He or she, as I define it, is an active Mormon who secretly has no testimony or of one or more of the fundamental tenets of the church, such as Joseph Smith's first vision or the divine origin of the Book of Mormon. Those are those restoration claims. Many come from strong church backgrounds, the offspring of traditional LDS parents, or they have been long-term committed converts. Some have served missions and others have married in the temple. Most have had close and important ties to the church, such as family, church jobs, or high church callings. What predisposes one to become a closet doubter? I don't have good answers. Education seems to be a contributing factor. Recent studies have suggested that some are genetically predisposed to believe, which means others are not so predisposed. Other factors seem to include intellectual curiosity, difficulties with authoritarian and male-dominated leadership, sexual orientation issues, knowledge of church history, and access to or reading anti-church literature. How many are there? You know, after my paper, I found out later that after I was given the paper in 1982, the church did a study called the Survey of Religion and Life in the U.S., Canada, and England. And I was actually invited about 2 or 3 years later to come down to the correlation department and actually review their findings, which was pretty amazing. This is what they came up with. The church's research arm of the correlation department suggests about 5% of all active adult Mormons in the USA may be undeclared doubters. I personally think it's much higher. It's a problem of the definition of what you consider doubt or doubters. My experience is that if you have someone's trust and then in a private moment ask the taboo question, is there anything about the church you question, you're likely to get a response, I guess I'm troubled by, and then whatever, polygamy for women mostly, and Nephi's murdering Laban, and how many kids I have to have in the afterlife, and all that kind of thing. So my guess is that many Latter-day Saints are in the closet on one issue or another. Why do they stay active? Reasons are legion. They're like any problem, there are the good presenting reasons and then the less obvious ones. Many, although feeling doubt, who are unconcerned about its origins, kind of like me, express commitments to the goals, principles, and practices of today's LDS church, people, and culture. They may state their presenting reason this way. You know, the presenting reason is the good reason. The underlying principles of the religion come from Christ's teachings and thus don't have their origin in Joseph Smith, and I can feel Christ and God's influence in my life, and so forth. Or they may say the church may not be true in the one and only true church sense, but there's nothing better, and few cause of doubters expect to find any true church. In fact, fewer are looking. But no doubters' motives for continuing activity are as pure and idealistic as I've just described. Most are tied to the church like birds are to Mother Earth. These gravitational ties include being married to a believing spouse. It might mean divorce or instability if I came out. The desire to give children stable support. I want my kids to have friends and a moral upbringing, family traditions and history. It would kill my mother if I went inactive. Security and pension programs when employed by the church or BYU. A social life revolving around friends who are believers. How can I attend my friend's temple wedding if I come out of the closet? Fear and hope. You know, these are important. The official Joseph Smith story might be true after all. Or Pascal's wager works for me. And then there's just the plain paralyzing inertia or laziness. I don't know what to do about it. I just don't know what to do. One more reason that those who are honest about their questions and doubts may see bleak prospects ahead. They may not feel a part of the acceptable central group, and they may be excluded from leadership and other trusted callings. They may be thwarted in their unwarranted need for power and control, and they don't want to only feel tolerated. How do they cope with the internal conflict? Long-term settled closet doubters, although not untroubled, seem to be relatively happy, fulfilled people with little hate or vindictiveness. We have probably a group sitting here today. Come to a personal understanding for themselves and find that, like other members of Fowler's faith stage 5 group, that it really doesn't matter. I'm going to stop here just for one second. The other night, I saw Hannah and her sisters with Woody Allen. You remember that show? At the end of the show, Woody's character goes into this, depressive funk, and he says, in a godless universe, I don't feel like I want to go on living, so I decide to kill myself. And so he gets this gun, and, you know, he's got the gun, and his hand's shaking, his forehead's all perspiring. Then he thinks, but what if there is a God? Maybe there is a God. But then he thinks, but no, maybe isn't good enough. I want certainty. So then the guy goes off. Fortunately, he's perspiring so much, the gun slips off his head and hits a mirror. But then he goes on a walk, and he says, in order to think logically and rationally, I think I'll go into this movie. Turns out it'll be one of those Marx Brothers movies where they have all the crazy antics going on. And he's looking up the screen, and he's thinking to himself, you know, he's seen all these people doing the crazy things, and he says, so what if the worst is true? So what if there's no God and you only go around once? Don't you want to be part of that experience? I should stop ruining my life searching for answers I'm never going to get. I just want to enjoy life while it lasts. Maybe is a slim read, but it's the best we've got. That's kind of the way some of us are who are still involved in the church and trying to do our best. Back to my text, the sanity that these settled closet doubters have is remarkable given the anguish they experienced during their futile struggles to get a testimony or during their often traumatic deconversion and loss of their testimony. Before admitting to the reality of their situations, many experience an agonizing transition period, usually measured in years and often filled with insecurity, alienation, anger, fear, and confusion. This transition state is often accompanied by strong feelings of guilt. I mustn't feel this way. I shouldn't have felt critical. Or I get upset reading church history. Why do I keep doing it? And feelings of denial. Of course I believe it's just a test. Or I've got to stop thinking this way. And feelings of shame. What kind of sinner must I be? And anger. You know, you have this loss. Why me? And the feelings of loneliness. I'm the only one with these thoughts and problems. Or there's no one else who understands. Given these emotional conflicts, it's not hard to understand why many have sought professional counseling and endured various psychological problems. Why not come out of the closet? The current LDS environment makes it seem difficult for closet doubters to come out of their closets, but after all, they are practicing a subtle dishonesty which cannot be healthy, so I generally encourage secret doubters to prepare themselves and their families for that eventual step. But there's no hurry, and when you think about it, parts of all of our lives are held private from other people, not just about our religious beliefs. Deep in the recesses of most of us are things even our spouses may not know. We can survive and even flourish when we are discreet and careful about things that might hurt others. this is a whole other issue that is covered in my book for those who wonder. And by the way, I give them and they sell them. They get to keep the money, so I'm not making any money on anything. What about my own experience? My own experience as a partial closet doubter has been relatively positive. Until I was about 50, I was a completely active member with high callings, etc., but without a divine testimony of the fundamentals, quietly in the closet, but open when specifically asked about it. When I did relate the facts of my testimony situation to, you know, my bishop's stake presence, tactfully and carefully, or to others, I'd often get the response, "Oh, Jeff, you believe more than you think," and so forth. If you read my recent Borderlands column in Sunstone, there's a more detailed history of my own in there. 12 years ago, when we moved to a new ward, I became somewhat less active, but have remained connected to and completely supportive of the church and its members. My bishops over these years have tried to get me active again, so about a year ago I offered a deal. I'd become totally active again if I could be completely open about my lack of a restoration testimony, my willingness to simply be faithful, and that I'd be treated like everyone else with callings, temple recommend, and so forth. He gulped and said, "Well, it doesn't take much to upset a ward." And what he was talking about was he was afraid that if I came out openly that I could cause others to lose their testimony. And I think he's right. It probably would. So we left it at that. But in recent months, I've been attending and slowly letting my situation be known. I'll let you know in my Sunstone Borderlands column how things go in the months and years to come. I see other benefits in being faithful and active. The LDS religion expects us to believe, even know, incredible claims. But participation can provide wonderful blessings. Those blessings are available to members who remain faithful to the teachings of Christ and who continue their participation in the church. But again, activity is a personal decision, and everyone must eventually choose the path which makes most sense to them. You know, I think given the interest in time, I'm going to let you read the rest of that on your own, just about, you know, what might happen in the future. But one last thought. Where I try to catch people at that time when they suddenly found out they don't have this testimony. And then there's this period of emergency stress. And some people are going to go jump off a cliff. And if they will just give themselves some time to think about it and look more reasonably and rationally at things, usually they come up with the right thing for themselves to do. And that's what we all need to kind of be aware of, you know, families with their friends and so forth. As they come to a realization that something is amiss in their life with regards to the church, you know, there's a safe haven if they'll just give themselves time. But that's the end of my presentation. Thank you very much.
Got quite a bit of time for questions and answers. Got about 30 minutes. I think I was the first person to ask or to choose the session that I would participate in, and I read everything, and I chose yours on purpose. And the reason is I was inactive for 20 years and came back. And just about everything that both of you are talking about, I've felt myself, and I think some of us here might have similar experiences you might want to share. Said some provocative things. I don't know, does anyone have any questions? Yes? And then.
Yes, you mentioned that you read on your mission certain books, and I, of course, know that the missionary format, the Book of Mormon, the literature that you're allowed to read. How did you determine what things you wanted to read? How did you access them, and who provided those for you?
Okay, well, when I first got to the MTC, I just wanted to read. I had never really read before in my life. I really can't say even today where it came from. And so I had the missionary library, and I had the scriptures, and I knew all the stories in the scriptures, but had never read the scriptures ever. I don't think I'd ever even made it through to anywhere past Nephi in the Book of Mormon. So probably for the first 2 or 3 months of my mission in the MTC, that's all I read. I finished the whole missionary library, and I read the standard works. And so that's what I spent all my time on. I would stay up late at night. If we had lunch in the apartment or anything like that, that's what I read. And then when I finished all that, I was just like, well, now what? And so it kind of led me to other things. And I think after reading all that, often thinking of my father and the things that happened, I'd never really read. I knew some of the details, but I'd never read any of the books written on that, and I just
was led to read those, and I read those, and that led me to other things. And then it just kind of dominoed from there. I just collected books, and I didn't really care if they said you can't read this or that, because to me that was just ludicrous. So, some of them were fine with it, and I probably only had one companion who was really upset with it, like, you shouldn't be reading this or that. But most of my companions, you know, I was pretty easy to get along with, and so, you know, I let them do their thing, and they let me do mine, so it wasn't really an issue with the companions. I didn't try to push stuff onto other people in the mission. I pretty much kept to myself, except for, you know, a few close people who I could talk to about things.
I'm not sure if we're supposed to be maybe repeating in here, so I'll try to do that. Sorry. The comment was Jared's coming back from the mission and what prompted him to be so open about his beliefs.
Yeah, I mean, I could talk for a while about that. I guess at first you are more closed-minded about it. I remember I went on my mission in June, and I had read a lot up until about December, which is when, you know, you talk to your family at Christmas time. And I remember talking to my mom, just kind of unloading everything that I had read. Just, this is what I, you know, on and on and on and on. And luckily my mom is very understanding and isn't naive to different issues. And so she was able to help me through that. And I was able to relate to a few people around me. And then as time went on, I just could tell that I had changed, and it wasn't, I guess, like it was said in an earlier discussion, you have to pick and choose when you're open and when you're not. But I can't really explain it, because I knew some missionaries who were somewhat like me but wouldn't ever dare venture into opening up to other people. But to me, I felt like just having integrity and honesty, that's what I needed to do. And so it's kind of frustrating when some people look at you like as a sinner for wanting to do this, or you're a sinner, so you're doing this. Like, I had a girlfriend since I've been home, and she's very Mormon, and when we went to the symposium in the summer, and she said to me, well, the people at work told me that Sunstone's anti-Mormons, you know, why are you anti-Mormon? And so I think it's just my own self be true, and I just wanted to have integrity and to be honest, and I guess that's what drives me. And then one more comment for now is still being involved with it, because then some people are like, well, you're questioning your faith, you're not active, why are you still involved with it? I love the church, I love the doctrine, and it's helped me progress, and there's so much to study in the church, it fascinates me, and it's probably my biggest hobby, and so it's something that I'll probably always be involved with, whether I'm active or not.
Have any of the church leadership contacted you after the publication to question as to what things you need to be answered, or have you made contact with any of them for working explanations of why and what?
That's a good question. The question was if any church officials had contacted me about my situation. Often many people have said to me, my mother and other people, maybe you should go talk to President Hinckley or so-and-so about why they said or lied about this or that. But to me, I don't really see a resolve in it. My older brother actually wrote President Hinckley a letter when he got off his mission, you know, detailing some of the things, asking, you know, wanting explanations to what happened and why this happened this way. And Hinckley didn't even write him back a letter. He had his secretary, Michael Watson, write him back a letter that just kind of dodged the issue. And so to me, that's just like, it's not worth it. It's not worth it to me to to contact them, and they haven't contacted me in any fashion. So,
I'm wondering, there's a way of, I don't know if you call it negotiation or testimony, that I find among many very active, faithful, and testimony-bearing Mormons. And I'm wondering if you would consider this closet doubting. But general authorities have told me that this is an approach that they use as well. It's just regular members. And that is the term is either put on the shelf or withhold judgment about a particular doctrine or whether something is right or wrong. How do you see that approach in terms of, you know, how you look at these issues of faith?
The question was dealing with testimony, you know, how you deal with problems that you haven't been able to resolve yet, I guess, negotiating your testimony. I'm not sure I'm repeating what you said exactly. Putting your problems on the shelf and compartmentalizing. I think it's, you know, we all do that. We have to do that because we have to assume that we don't all have perfect knowledge. And, you know, thanks for the question. If we don't do that, then we leave ourselves open to more negative aspects coming in our lives. We either reject quickly and don't pursue it, and then we end up outside the church. I think a lot of people do. I mentioned in one of the Borderland columns that one of the things we need to do is to ensure that we don't become easy true believers in the anti-Mormon stuff, and I put that kind of in that category. There are all kinds of questions that we may have which are not resolved yet, and we can simply say, well, I'll set this aside or learn about it later. In the meantime, I'll let my faith bridge this gap until I do. And we have to be careful about how we talk to others, because I do genuinely believe that if we bring up things to some people whose faith is kind of built on sandy ground, we are likely to hinder their faith progression. And some people are going to be on sandy ground all their lives, and it's not necessarily up to us to bring all these things up to them. But I don't know if I'm answering your question or not, but you know the answer. I know you do already.
I was just wondering how you would define that. Do you see that as closet doubting under a different name, or would you see it as something different from closet doubting?
The question was, is this closet doubting? Yes, I think it is. I don't see closet doubting necessarily as a bad thing. I just think it's a phenomenon that we have. I wish it wasn't there. I wish we could all be just completely open with each other. But given circumstances in the church right now, until the time when, you know, the demand for testimony goes away and faith is acceptable in the place of testimony, I should have read the rest of my paper. when we reach that point, then we can be much more open. And in the meantime, we have no other choice but either be closet doubters, at least to some degree, or we're going to be completely open and be ostracized, or we're going to be out. You know, so I hope we get to that situation.
I'm not sure whose hand. Ladies first, yes?
I have two comments, and I'm not sure that it's going to come out of comments or questions.
But, I suggest if you're going to make a comment, why don't you just come on up and go to the microphone?
No.
Come on. Yeah. It won't hurt.
I sat in an interview with the state president at one time, and it was a rather long interview, and we spoke about different things, and he said to me, you know, the worst thing that can happen is that it isn't true at all, and then we just live our lives the best way you know how to do. I was very appreciative of that. I'm wondering if there aren't other people who have had the same type of experiences with leaders in our wards and stakes. I myself have borne testimony and
stood and said, you know, there are times when I know it's true from the top of my head to the bottom of my toes, and the rest of the time I hope it's true. And have not found myself, said that in open testimony, in testimony meeting, and not had any negative comments or reaction whatsoever. So I guess I'm a little bit confused about the need to be in closet about our concerns, because to me, they've been expressed openly from both myself and from other members of the church serving in positions of authority who did not appear to me to be hiding it, but were perhaps thought very diligently to give a balance between both the faith and the doubt.
I think that's a good point, recognizing all the good that the church does, and I think my mom has your same viewpoint and often says to me, well, why don't you just stay in the church? You do believe certain things and it'll be good for your life. And I understand that. If I could be like everyone else, I realize that would make my life a lot easier. Where my problem comes from, some people might have that view, but in the church I don't think you can have that view. The reason why is we have to have temple recommend interviews where you have to answer yes to questions. Do you sustain so-and-so? Yes. Do you do this? Yes. You can't say, well, sometimes I just hope, I don't know, because in that, to me, that's being dishonest. I would have to be dishonest to have a temple recommend. I would have to be dishonest to use the priesthood. It would be great for me if I could be in the church, not have to go to the temple, not use my priesthood. I could raise my family with the morals, but that's not going to happen. No girl's going to want to marry someone who has faith and questions some things. So, right. I mean, there will be some, but I mean, the majority of girls isn't going to want to be with someone who's not going to go to the temple or who's not going to, you know, use their priesthood to do X, Y, and Z.
I just wanted to share a couple of comments as someone who's come out of the closet, but who is still active in my ward. I've had a mixed response, maybe half between the two of you. The situation in which I can I just give a little background here? I don't want to take up too much time. I'm a convert to the church. My parents were very much against joining, and so when I went away to college to UCI, I walked into a ward, approached the sister missionaries, and said, "Hi, I'd like to join." I already knew all the doctrine. It was just add water. So I became something of a little legend in my ward, and I left on my mission from that ward. They supported me. I served a faithful mission, came back, married. Then I went away for several years, and in the interim, asked all sorts of questions and eroded my faith away, which I don't see as a negative. I have to be careful about how I use that, because I don't like the phrase "I lost my testimony," because that implies something very negative. And in my situation, I feel like I've gained things, and maybe you can relate. And others maybe can relate. But anyhow, I returned to that same ward. I now have a job at UCI. And everybody had this perception of me as this, John, golden, convert. And so in that situation, I felt a need to get up at the pulpit and scare the pants off the bishop and let everybody know that, because I didn't give specifics about what I didn't believe, but I said that I could not hold a temple recommend because I could not answer all of the belief questions. And I don't have the situation where sometimes I believe it from my head to my toe. I'm pretty certain in my unbelief, I guess, of certain principles. And so, really mixed response to that. I mean, some people bore testimony in tears to me in the hallways, and others, some people I haven't talked to since, who were close to me at one point. But on the other hand, my remaining active, even though on the fringes, I feel like I have some freedom to say things that no one else can say. And I'm careful. I don't say things that are way out there, but I try to say things that are just on the fringe that I think are enlightening. I'm not trying to destroy everybody's testimonies or anything. And what's happened is I've found a core of people who I feel love the truth. I'd like to say love the truth more than they love Mormonism in the case that there might be a conflict between the two, if people are willing to go there. And so it's turned out to be a positive experience in that I now have a core supportive group of people who are kind of on the fringe. It's been a good experience. So the other thing I want to say is almost every quote you mentioned, I was like, yes, that's... So those quotes are sustaining. They give it
a I think back here and then John after.
I don't know how I would classify myself. I don't know if it's closet doubter or just somebody who's really not that interested in kind of the cultural side of the church. And so I would just suggest or propose, personally, I mean, through for professional reasons, really, I've lived in congregations where the church is at a very early developmental stage. So I've lived primarily in branches. And it's a wonderful experience. You know, the focus is just on basically just people getting to the core of their beliefs and, like, living their life. And not worrying about if there's a lace tablecloth on the Relief Society lesson. And so I guess just to share, it's not really a question, but just to share that that's something that has really enriched my spiritual life, is to just be in a situation where you're just focusing on the basics.
Oh, okay. This question is for Jared. Okay, I got a question. I'm going to play a little bit devil's advocate for you, okay? And in doing so, I stayed up front in the utmost respect. Okay, I in no way, shape, or form trying to, you know, be disrespectful to you whatsoever. Okay, so a quick analogy. Let's say you're going to a hospital for treatments, you know, immunizations and such, and you find out that the doctor who's been treating you, giving you all these immunizations, has... is a scoundrel. You know, he's been giving you placebos and bilking you, and you know, a total deception. You feel completely betrayed, and so as a result, you say, "Well, fine, I'm just not going to go to the hospital anymore." You know, so my question to you is, has it crossed your mind that you might be the pain and all the deception and the hurt that you've encountered from church leaders might be an emotional knee-jerk reaction, and you just want to throw the whole hospital out the window?
You know, that's a very valid question, and I could see how you would think that. But actually, most of my main concerns and problems with the church doesn't have anything to do with my father's death at all. It's more church-free doctrinal stuff. I often have people say, like, they'll bring that up to me and be like, well, can't you just forgive them? If they did lie, you know, can't you forgive them? And that's fine, I can forgive them, but for me that's the difference between forgiving someone and then sustaining them as my leader. And, but yeah, that is a good question, but if I think even if that wasn't in my life, with everything else that I have inside of me, I think I would be in the same place that I'm at right now.
Just a quick statement about this whole business of putting things on the shelves. For a number of years, as I struggled through various issues in the church, a lot of people have asked me to do that. And it seemed like eventually they asked me to put myself on the shelf, essentially. And I think the hardest thing for me is that the process of questioning my original faith, which is Hinduism, that brought me here was at first started by the church, by the missionaries, by the church, as you say, yeah, you should question your faith, you should ask these questions, you should do this. But then, once I came in, then I'm asked to put everything back on the shelf. And I wonder, do any of you, either of you or anybody here, ever believe that there'll ever come a time of true openness in the church where people can honestly just say, you know what, I believe this, this is where I'm at, and that they'll be accepted for it?
That's a great question. I personally hope that we get to that point, and I'd like to see it in my lifetime, but I think for the church to continue to grow and expand in the world, they'll have to eventually soften the necessity of having the testimony and having all the answers and otherwise keeping yourself on the shelf. You know, it's just let's hope and all, let's all hope and pray for that end. You've hit it right on the nose.
I think Mike wants to make a comment.
I think it can also be like a diversity of personality.
Can be a diversity of personality. I'm going to make this very short. In the 50s, general authorities were freer to say things that weren't correlated. That term didn't exist in the church then. But in the 1950s, most of the outspoken general authorities were very doctrinaire. Joseph Fielding Smith, Mark E. Peterson, and at that point, McConkie, Bruce R. McConkie, although he wasn't an apostle. Very doctrinaire, very emphatic about what the gospel was, what you should be doing, how you should think, how you should feel. And Hubie Brown came down to BYU at one point, and I learned this when I was a student at BYU. One of the professors there told me about this visit. And he spoke to the students at BYU, and he said, I hope that whatever your faith and view of the church and the gospel is today, that 5 years from now, it will be very different. Now that's an open-ended idea of what testimony means. And that's not what other general authorities at the time were teaching should be a testimony. And it could be that there will be other general authorities down the road who will feel the freedom to say that. They may not say it at General Conference. I don't think he ever did. A general conference, but he said those kinds of things in settings where he felt that it would be effective, particularly to BYU students. He's also the one at a later time when he was a member in the first presidency who to BYU students, our concern is not that you have orthodox thoughts, but that you think. And again, he didn't say that in general conference. So he was careful in his audiences, but I think that may be what will happen, that there will be general authorities who have the confidence that they can speak that frankly.
I think I disagree with what both of these gentlemen have said, and I think that from the time the church began until now, it's became more and more to where it's becoming more closed-minded and more closed-minded. And I mean, looking at a couple of examples, the missionaries now, you can't go on a mission now unless you have a testimony. They raised the bar. Ballard said that himself. If you don't have a testimony, we don't need you. You can't go on a mission to get one. And I think that's amazing in itself. I wonder how many people who actually go on a mission really have studied out and have that testimony that I think you wish people would have.
Just a quick anecdote that happened to me a couple weeks ago in gospel doctrine class. We were, the team asked us to offer up characteristics of the people of Christ, and she was writing them on the board, and someone said minded, and I'm thinking, oh yes, you know, victory at last. And she wrote open-mindedness on the board, and then she paused and she said, do you really mean humility? And I'm thinking, oh, you know, because somebody offered it. And he kind of, you know, and I'm like, oh, don't back down, don't back down. And he's like, well, yeah, you know, any kind of, you know, backpedal. And she, I'm not kidding you, line through open-mindedness, humility. Two very different things. And what he was really saying was we need to be open to one another and to one another's soul things, the things to say and to each other. But there was still that someone said it, you know, and so maybe, but it's we've got a ways to go. So, but
just wanted to share that.
Actually, yeah, we still have 15 minutes.
Just a quick question for Jeff. You mentioned in your paper that when you were active, you held some high positions. And I was wondering, did in any of those positions were you ever required to question someone on their testimony? And if you were, how did you handle it?
Well, I've been a branch president and two bishops on the state guy council and all those kind of things. I never asked anybody, you know, do you have a testimony in that sense? I mean, I've asked lots of people about their testimony, but only to be private. When people ask me about my own testimony, I was, you know, I was open about it. So I'd say, well, you know, I don't have the kind of testimony that you talk about, but you know, I'm willing to take it on faith. Use that's good enough. You know, you go to get temple recommended, same thing. You could say, well, you know, I don't know this. I don't have that burning testimony of the restoration of Christ, but I'm willing to take it on faith. That's always good enough for most bishops. But when I was interviewing people myself, I didn't press them on that. I just looked at the person.
We were discussing about being open in the church. I think to a large degree, we can have an impact in the way, the kind of language we believe. I'm a big believer that the way we talk in the church is very, it creates a lot of boundaries. It makes people feel excluded. It puts up a lot of barriers. And I think some of the experiences I've had that have made me more comfortable with the evolution of my testimony is simply to hear somebody say, get up and say, I believe, instead of I know. Or to get up and express struggle they've had with something. Or to find new words to say things instead of some of the ways that culturally people have always spoken in the church. I find the language pretty constricting. And so I think by being ourselves and being open, whether it's this much or, you know, whatever we're comfortable with, I think it invites people to express themselves. And it might be a very slow process, but I have noticed that oftentimes I have not been very vocal in church. My husband here has been much more vocal. And oftentimes he's left and people have come up to me and said, and expressed their doubts and, you know, various experiences. And I'm sure, and they've also done it to him as well, but a lot of people aren't willing, you know, to do that, but it takes somebody to crack the window a little bit and invite others to do the same. And so I think we can have an impact on that. Unfortunately, I do think it's sort of a very long process, but I don't think it's impenetrable in the long, long run.
The last 45 years or so, I've been dealing with this issue. When I went on my mission, I talked to the bishop. I wanted to go to a non-Christian nation. I wanted to go to Japan, and he wrote across the top of the form, you know, there's no place in the form request, you know, Jeff wants to go to Japan. And fortunately, I got to go over there, and of course, I felt very comfortable in converting people to Christianity, and I feel like, you know, I'm a Mormon Christian and that kind of thing, and I feel very strongly about that. But when I got over there, I found out, fortunately for me, they used the word shinjiru to bear their testimony, which was not I know. It was more I think, you know, or I believe. So that was helpful, you know. And you know, I had another thought in there, but it's gone away, I guess. But yeah, it's, well, I'll let it be there.
Too. And again, maybe it comes from having lived like in like fringe congregations, but this theory that to be a member of the, to convert to Mormonism, you have to be a fanatic. Like you have to have that strength within yourself to make the commitment it takes to join not just this religion, but also a community and to change your way of life. And so I think that fosters kind of the lack of acceptance or just a lack of a place for closet doubters or people who question I do think it goes back to this fanaticism, and as you were saying too, it's the language, it's the I know, and you have to have this revelation.
I wonder how you see some of our own reactions, as well as I think you've alluded to the fact that by reading church history, it's caused you to have some concerns. And while I'm an adult convert, it's only recently that I've started reading church history, and I will be, you know, very frank about there are things that I've read there that have certainly rattled my cage more than a little bit. But I'd like to relate that experience to something that I learned very early on in my membership in the church. I was probably reading to my children out of the Children's Friend or something, and it is a little story about fear and a little boy who felt afraid in bed, and little kids lots of times feel afraid when they're in the room at night, and he had to find the courage to work past the fear and get out of his bed and down on his knees the way he'd been taught. And lots of times my husband and I kid when we're tired at night, well, will the prayer count if we're, you know, laying here, or, you know, do we have to get up on our knees? And the reason I want to talk about fear is because I think probably we're not the only ones who feel fear. I used to stake a president who said, talk about things that lock you into places that are not comfortable to be. It's a foolish Latter-day Saint who doesn't live so as to have the Holy Spirit as their constant companion. I don't know about those of you who are active in the church, but it's my experience that having the Holy Ghost as a companion requires inordinate, huge amounts of energy and concentration and very purposeful thought. And so I don't think the Holy Ghost is my constant companion. I have to work very hard to feel that I'm being guided. And I certainly have come to believe in my own life that when I'm fearful, whether it's fearful of what someone else is going to think, maybe what people, you know, looking at church authorities are going to think, we respond in ways that are less than inspired. As I look at church history, the Mountain Meadows Massacre and responses to that, the things that happened in Missouri, it comes to my mind that there must be a huge amount of fear, or probably was a huge amount of fear in the minds of authorities as to how our own members would respond, and huge mistakes were probably made as a result of not just lack of knowledge, but fear on top of lack of knowledge. And I wonder how you see, you know, I've heard, you know, some comments as to, I can forgive, but I can't accept these people as my leaders. I can't sustain them as leaders. I know I have responded very poorly in moments of anxiety or fear. It does not, I'm not saying it justifies, but I guess, how would you suggest in your own lives working past fear of being ostracized from a congregation, or fear of losing a job because you are LDS, or whatever it is, how could we as individuals work past the fear so that we are more likely to be inspired, or at least to be able to think at least as charitably about our neighbor as we were thinking about saving our own skins? And how does that relate to this whole issue?
Well, the facile answer, of course, love becomes fear, you know, as the song goes. But we all have to deal with those kind of problems on an individual basis. And, you know, if you fall back on the gospel, we could go into that. But I don't really know the answer to that for you. I know what it is for me, and Jared probably knows what it is for him. But
Dan wanted to say something. I want to hear what he has to say.
I think that's a good point, and I can understand that, you know, even prophets and every apostle is imperfect and they make mistakes. And I mean, were you trying to say that lots of times they make these bad decisions based on that emotion of fear, and anyone would do that same type of thing? Is that what you were trying to portray? Or
I'm saying, I'm guessing in that moment they were less empathetic.
Right. And that happens to all of us, and that happens a lot in church history. I think it's harder for me to accept the ones that don't come out of fear. I think maybe we should use passion instead of fear. They're crimes of passion or the heat of the moment, and it's just human nature that natural man that comes out, but I think that there also have been a lot of calculated errors that aren't out of fear, but they're actually calculated and they're premeditated.
I think that if you...
talk about decisions and making mistakes, we all make mistakes in life. We do things that sometimes we regret. And I can forgive somebody for making a mistake. My kids make mistakes. I've made mistakes. Where I don't forgive is when they perpetuate that mistake. And that comes from lying. And when you lie, that is a deliberate act where you knowingly are doing something that is reproducing the error of your judgment in the first place. And I see that that's where some of the general authorities have the problem. I don't fault them because they don't know everything and they're going to make mistakes and decisions that they regret after they've made them. But when they do something and then don't own up to it and are honest about it, that's when I draw the line.
I thought it was a terrific session. Obviously, how many people have made a comment today? Obviously, this is just terrific, you guys. So I appreciate that so much. A million things come up to me. I really wanted to talk when you started talking, but you hit on about all the things that I was going to talk about. So one of the things that I think is a real helpful thing is, first of all, Jeff and I are pretty sympathetic about what we want Sunstone to do. And that's to help people successfully negotiate, not rush to throw the baby out with the bathwater and all those things. And to sort of make people feel like that if I am a closet dad or something like that, I don't have to feel alone, you know, and things like that. But one of the things that John Remy said, you know, half hour ago, which was just terrific, is that he's successfully negotiated a place within his ward in a gentle way. That it almost becomes a self-calling. And Neil Chandler wrote an article about 15 years ago, I don't know if you ever read it, it was about the kind of the self-calling of the ward intellectual. And he used that word. But it really is something, and if you're successfully able to do it, either as a gospel doctrine teacher who just ask that 10% deeper question or a more open-minded sort of question or something like that, there is a role, I think, for closet doubter type folks, borderlanders, whatever you'd want to call it, as guess what happens? You are the one that people will sidle up to in the foyer, or that you'll get the phone call late at night on the crisis of faith. You can really be in service to the community. And so, you know, it's not fun to not feel I'm in the zone one of Jeff's little, looks like a fried egg to me kind of chart. We should maybe redo that little chart for our the magazine thing or something like that. It's not fun, but boy, it can be in service to a lot of people like Jeff works. So that was the main thoughts of a million others, but that was that.
Just a real quick comment. I think for a long time, I don't know if that's the ward intellectual or if it's the, I think some of the court jester, and I think I played that role for a long time. Yeah, exactly. And I can completely sympathize with Jared. I think after 12 years of trying my best to try and get people to think just even slightly differently or use their language a little differently, and of putting my wife through many agonizing post-church sessions, I just ended up getting exhausted. So I don't know if you ever addressed that in your column, but at some point the borderlanders, just through, not through even necessarily intent, but just through mere exhaustion, I think just end up leaving, because I think so for so long we get marginalized and people just don't care. You know, honestly, I think the worst thing that can happen is apathy. And for those of you who are active and go to church, if you do ever see somebody who is, you know, like that, if you even one or two words of encouragement goes a long ways, because now I think like I can relate a lot more to Jared and what he's going through and the point where he's at than I can, let's say, with my wife. But you know, I think we all have a place, and the thing that sustains me is in my heart I know that Heavenly Father and Heavenly Mother, they love all of us, you know, and you know, me included. So.
John, about 1 minute, and that's, I think, you'll be the last one.
I just had a quick comment. This comes from almost complete burnout of having been a member since '77, but not converted. And that's a complex story. I don't want to.